It's just it just keeps us from rambling. Is what it is.
Exactly.
So did everybody hear the beep?
I did not.
Oh, okay. Well, we're recording now.
That's awesome. That's a great way to intro it.
All right. Okay.
Professionalism right out the window. Yeah.
Well, you know, it is Rogues Radio Podcast. It's not like, you know, I don't know, something else. It's not like NPR. So
there you go.
Okay. All right.
I can do an NPR voice if we need to.
Well, there you go.
Here we go. Hello. How are we?
Great, Al. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you, Lynn?
Fine. Good morning,
Dave. It's just shy of creepy guy who lives on your street. That's NPR.
Oh yeah.
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 Okay, so let's get into the intro. So I'm gonna do the welcome and do the intro here, and then I'll throw it to you, Lynn. And after you're done, Lynn, I'll jump right in and plug Al, and that'll be the end of our first segment. Okay.
That was the dirtiest thing you've said on the podcast so far.
What?
It's gonna plug Al.
Oh God.
All right. Go ahead.
Thanks, Lynn. Awesome. Hey. Okay. Welcome to episode 4 of the Rogues Radio Podcast. My name is Dave Beatty, and for the last 2 decades, I've been a professional comic artist and graphic designer. Some of my published credits are Batman Incorporated, Flashpoint Wonder Woman, Superboy, and the X-Men. I am also the co-creator of several independent comic book series such as Star Gods, Bushytails, and Red Skirts. Joining me is my co-host, Mr. Lynn Workman. Lynn, please tell the listeners a little bit about what you've done as an artist and a designer.
Well, for about the past 30 years or so, I've been a screen printer by day, graphic artist by night and weekends. And that was me on the drums, eh?
All right. So, on this very special episode of the podcast, we welcome our first guest, writer-artist Mr. Al Sparrow. Al is the writer of the independent comic book series Thugs, Red Skirts, the webcomic Barbarian, and also a contributing writer for the Mad Magazine of the Automotive Scene Cartoons Magazine.
Yay!
Yay, Al! Yay!
I told you I was talkative.
There was much rejoicing.
Yay!
Right.
Well, happy to be your first guest. I don't know if that speaks good or bad to the podcast that I'm your first guest. But
well, Stan Lee wouldn't return our calls, so you were second on the list.
He's a busy man. So
he is.
Doing all those cameos.
So as we do on every episode of the Rogues Radio Podcast, our first kind of segment is just to talk about what we're currently working on. Just as the last several episodes, not much has changed. I'm still working on Red Skirts. Been having some challenges within the studio, the YouTube show. The YouTube show may be becoming a Vimeo show soon because I've been just having all kinds of weird issues with YouTube. And I'm not trying to monetize anything on there. We're just trying to just talk about fun stuff and entertain people. So I may be moving the show here pretty soon. So that's the big update for In the Studio. And then as far as the podcast is going, I did submit us for TuneIn. If TuneIn accepts us and we get on that, eventually we'll be on Amazon and you'll be able to listen to the show on the Alexa. So that'll be kind of fun. But I haven't heard back on that yet. And I still haven't heard back from iTunes. I've given up on that. So So that's the update for the show. What have you got going on, Lynn?
Wrapping up that Spider-Man cover that I was telling you I was working on last time. I've got almost all the colors done, so I'll be inking it and doing some highlights and stuff like that this tonight. And I've got another sketch cover I've got to get jumping on. And then after that, as soon, hopefully this weekend, hopefully the weather will kind of cool off a bit. I just got contacted by the Theater Memphis, and they want me to do a painting for their Dracula show that's coming up. I've done a couple of art shows there in their lobby. They wanted to know if I wanted to do the show by myself, and I was like, yeah, there's no way I can get 10 to 12 paintings done in a month.
Right.
So I said I can get you one, maybe two. So I'll be doing my usual black and white monster pieces. It's about 3 by 4 foot. So we do those, and then after that, I've got to jump on and get a painting ready for the Orpheum auction. The Orpheum Theater downtown Memphis does a annual auction, and I always try to donate something to it. I used to paint canvas chairs for them, and they use the money for their Halloran Center, Performance Center next door, which just opened this last year or before last. We went in there. We had to take a tour of it. They invited all the artists that have donated to the auction before out there and gave us a tour and asked us about, our opinions on moving forward on the auction and that sort of thing. It's really, really amazing place. It's really cool to donate stuff to a worthy cause, but to actually see it come to fruition, and actually be able to walk around in the building and not just look at architect plans or architectural renderings was really, really cool. So I'm looking forward to that, because I didn't get to do anything for him last year because of the whole heart situation and doing the bypass surgery, because I was in ICU the night of the auction, so couldn't make it to that one. So, but that's what I've been up to, or will be up to. And Al, our first guest, what Ta-da. Have you been up to? Yeah, what have you been up to lately?
No good. Ha ha! Waka waka waka. Dave and I are wrapping up the first episode of Red Skirts. Gonna put the final page up that he has sent, which closes out the first episode. Probably not this upcoming week, but next. We've been doing kind of a every two week posting thing. So anybody listening, if you're curious about Red Skirts, we're gonna talk about that a bit more later. But now is a good chance to come in, because the entire episode will be up and available for your viewing pleasure. I also just sent off to Steve Reed, who is the artist on Thugs, our script for issue 10. We plan to do a full 12 issues, and I'm actually trying to write issue 12 now, even though I haven't written issue 11, just so we know where everything ends. Mm-hmm. And so that's been kind of an interesting experiment too, because it's like when we started Thugs, it was just he wanted something to draw and he needed somebody who knew comics to write, and somehow Steve came to me and we just did 6 kind of pages as a gag, and we were just having fun with it. And after we get done with page 6, we both kind of looked at each other and said, so what happens next? So Thugs has always been kind of a seat of the pants type of operation, and that's what's made it fun. By contrast to Red Skirts, where when we talk about it, we'll probably talk about how I gave Dave 70 pages worth of back material unexpectedly. But those are two things I'm working on with other people now. On my own, I am working on a couple fun projects that are basically just for my own gratification and my own sense of fun. And one of them is a comic called Twitch. And basically, Twitch came out of an undiscovered love that I have for all those great horror magazines like Eerie and Creepy and, most importantly, Vampirella.
Oh, yeah.
The reason I love Vampirella so much is I hadn't discovered this. There's a website out there that will show you what comics were published the month you were born. And it's a fun little website, and I do not have the website to give out to you, but do a little searching. I'll bet you can find it. And it was just really interesting. Of all the notable comics that came out the month that I was born and the year that I was born, Vampirella #1 hit. So we share a birthday.
Oh.
And I was never a big fan of horror comics. I was never a big fan of them at all, to be honest. I didn't like being scared. Halloween was great because you got candy, but I did not like all the horror aspects of it. I was just never a fan as a kid. But I figured, okay, well, this is interesting. Here's Vampirella. And they had just started, Dynamite had just started putting out all these amazing anthologies. Big, expensive, $50, you know, death-dealing hardbacks that collected the entire run.
Which I would highly recommend to people because those are beautiful.
I now own all 17 of them. I'm on number 5. I'm working my way through it. Hopefully, I will be done reading them before I die. That's my when I retire, I will finally have time enough to read everything, and then just like Burgess Meredith, my glasses are going to break. No sooner had I opened that first page of the first archive, and I was just blown away. My God, the artwork in these things is just incredible. And I'm not just saying that on a prurient level of, wow, Vampirella's wearing a tissue. No, the stories are amazingly well written. There's some hack named Neil Adams in the first issue. And I don't know that he ever made a name for himself in the industry, but he's in there. There's all these other amazing, talented artists. Jose Gonzalez is kind of the standard Vampirella artist. And, you know, just looking at his artwork is drool-inducing, and again, not just because Vampirella's wearing a tissue. He draws demons and architecture and all kinds of stuff just on a level that so few artists today, I'm willing to throw it down, can even touch. Amazing, amazing stuff. So, as I started reading, I started falling in love with it, because the beauty of these archives is they keep all the ads in, and they keep all the other fun junk that we used to have in our funny books, and we don't anymore. So I got this idea a few Drawloweens back, which for those of you listening, hopefully this will come out before Halloween. In October, artists go nuts with this fun little project called Drawloween or Inktober, or there's a lot of different names for it, and every day you are given a new theme to draw from. So a couple years back, I thought, what the heck, let's participate, and I started drawing, and I just kept coming back to these two witches. And they're the standard sexy witch stereotypes that you always hear about, but I tried to make them, you know, have more of a personality to them. They're not just eye candy, and they've been best friends since they were little kids. Well, all this slowly developed into merging with my love of Vampirella and Creepy and Eerie, and it's like, let's make a book. Let's make a horror magazine type. I'm actually trying to print it in magazine format. I'm talking to printers who can go the old newsprint route and, you know, make it look old and crappy, you know, like it's been around for a while. So just something I'm having fun with. And there's a whole storyline behind it that actually involves the audience. And it's just an excuse to get out and draw cute witches, sure, but also to test my short story writing skills. I have all these short stories that are kind of have a horror bent to them if I tweak them the right way. And I had no real outlet where to put them or anything like that, and it's like, well, what have you put them in this book? So it's Twitch, which is two witches, so T-W-I-T-C-H, so Twitch. And if I do one issue, great. If I can get to a second one, you know, I've got the material ready to go. But I think it's going to be just a lot of fun for people who really get into that kind of thing. And there's more than a few people out there who have had that same basic idea. There's a great book called Creeps that reprints a lot of the old Frazetta and stuff from way back when, along with new material, and they try and follow that same format. And, you know, so there's a bunch of us out there who I guess either found their influence later in life like I did, or, you know, have been there from the very beginning. And then I'm also working, you know, because I don't have enough on my plate, on kind of an underground comic. I don't know how much of an underground comic it is, because honestly, it's some of the best artwork I've ever done, so who knows. But it's about an elf in a fantasy setting who, if you know your fantasy literature, most elves are like David Bowie, very androgynous looking, and that's the women. Well, I have an elf who's a freak. She actually got born with a decent-sized rack, and because of that, she's become an outcast among her people. And the controversy behind it is she gets nicknamed Tits. And it's one of those things like the old Wendy and Richard Peeney ElfQuest thing, where once your true name is discovered, that's the name that's stuck with you. So I worry that people are seeing what I'm creating with her and thinking, oh, well, this is going to be porn. And it's not. It's really designed to be more about you don't get to pick your own nickname. And really, the problem that people have is on their own end, not yours, if you have something different about you. I don't know that that's going to come across in this. I hope it will. You know, I'll definitely know if people come up and they're outraged by it based on the title alone. I'll know they haven't read it because, you know, there's no content inside the book that's that way. I actually did have someone saying, I want to back this when you make it a book. And I'm like, you do know it's not going to be what you think it is. And he's like, I don't care. I've heard this idea and I like it. So, you know, it's fun.
You're just hoping for cosplayers.
Cosplayers, definitely, yes. Well, definitely, sure. And that's the thing. The cosplay for this, every drawing I've ever done of her, except for a joke, she has more clothes on her than Red Sonja ever thought about wearing. So, you know, I keep her well attired. And, you know, I made a whole set of rules kind of like Chuck Jones did for Wile E. Coyote. You know, there's kind of a famous thing where he lists like 8 rules about the coyote. And rule number 1 for tits is nobody's ever going to see him.
There you go.
That's pretty much it. The joke, yeah, it's her nickname, but it's not what she's about.
And, very cool. You
know, yeah, I mean, it's a fun idea, and it's really my wife's fault. I need to say that because she's not here. You know, you talk about where crazy ideas come from. We're both pretty avid Elder Scrolls Online players, which is why my comics don't come out a lot quicker. Because I'm usually wasting time playing characters. So I'm making an elf character, you know, and I'm one of those people who, when you're creating your character, if the game gives you enough of an engine to really make an intricate-looking character, come back in a couple hours and I'll still be working on it. So my wife let me go, and I'm chugging away, and I'm still working on facial features and tweaking this, that, and the other thing. And my wife comes in the room, are you still making the character? I want you to start playing now. You know, she like lays the edict down. So I had to rush through everything else. So we go through all this character creation for my little elf character and what have you, and she's running through, killing things left, right, and sideways. Well, a little bit later on, my wife walks back in the room, and we notice that every single person that I come to talk to, this is kind of a first-person perspective, I'm coming up to their chest. Mm-hmm. And the reason is I didn't have time to adjust the height on my character. So she is like the smallest, tiniest character in the Elder Scrolls Online universe that I have seen yet. And the problem is I also didn't have time to adjust chest features. So it looks like she's got this Dolly Parton rack on her, but she's this real tiny little thing. And my wife is just like, Jesus Christ, you just created Tits the Elf. And I'm like, a lightning bolt hit over my head. And I'm like, that is fucking brilliant.
Yeah.
Pardon the F-bomb. I know we... there it is. It really was just something that hit, and I'm like, okay. In my mind, I was like, you need to pursue this, but you need to be really careful about how you pursue this. So we'll see.
Right.
My audience tends to be more of the sick and twisted and older variety, so I think my audience is out there for this. We'll see. And I think that's enough.
So, we've all known each other for several years now. Lynn, please tell the listeners how we all first met.
Okay, so you're asking the guy that's the oldest with the worst memory to remember how we all met. All right,
yes.
I'm going to give it a shot.
It's a test.
I believe we all kind of first met through the CGS message boards, if I'm correct.
Comic Geek Speak, yes.
Yes, yeah, Comic Geek Speak, back in the day when they... kids, do you remember what message boards were? Okay. That's kind of what we did before, you know, Facebook and all that hit. I remember meeting there, and I also remember running into Al at the Phoenix Comic Con back when it was in Mesa and was called Cactus Con. So I guess that's kind of how we all met, was through CGS and through the Phoenix Con.
Yeah, I remember actively seeking you guys out because I found out through CGS, hey, these guys are semi-local. So, yeah, I need to go find them. And sure enough, it was at that Phoenix Con, and I picked up my first issues of Bushy Tales and picked up some artwork by Dave inadvertently, which was a lot of fun. And that started a long love affair of picking up Dave's artwork and trying to get Lynn's artwork as well, basically it's, through auctions.
Yeah, my artwork's a lot more rare because I don't do a lot.
Well, I have a couple interesting auction stories, which I'll try and be brief on. The first day Beatty artwork I ever picked up was at that Cactus Con auction back when they did auctions. They've kind of shied away from doing that lately, which, you know, editorial comment, boo, because auctions are great.
That was my favorite thing about the show every year, and they just did away with it.
They just stopped it. But sure enough, a picture of Dave's main character from Bushy Tales, fully painted. I still have it. It's on my wall. But it's one of those things, and hopefully this hopefully won't hurt any feelings. They put it up there and like forbid, and nobody was bidding. And I was like, why? This is a gorgeous piece of artwork. And it was just the struggles of independent comics. It wasn't Iron Man. It wasn't
right.
You know, it wasn't a known character. And so I was like, screw it, I'll bid on this. And you know, I bid on it basically because I'd met you guys and I was like, you know, I consider these guys friends. I'm going to get the bidding rolling. So I threw my hand up and said, you know, whatever they were asking. And I figure, okay, that'll get the ball rolling. Somebody will probably outbid me. And nobody outbid me. And
and you got stuck with it.
Yeah. The next thing I know, well, I was happy to get stuck with it. In fact, mutual friend Ed Harris, most of you guys or might remember him.
Yeah,
he kind of leaned over and was like, do you want me to outbid you on this? Because I'm like, no, I want it if I can get it for, you know, what they're asking. I wish other people would bid. And, you know, so I've still got the artwork to this day. I still love it. When I try to paint myself, I look at it and go, God, I suck.
I believe that was the same auction that I brought a Smallville Tom Welling painting to. Because back then you could actually take stuff on, you know, wrap up a painting and box it up really good and use it as checked luggage.
Right.
So I brought it out. And nobody was bidding on it. And then Tess Fowler started, you know, she bid on it. And I think she got the paint. It was like about a 2x3, 3x4 size airbrush painting of Tom Welling for like $75. Because nobody else bid against it. And Micah was like, can I get a picture of you two together with the painting? And Tess kind of looks at me and looks at her like, okay. Because I mean, I'd met Tess that day, you know, earlier that day. But she didn't know that I was the one that donated the painting. So she looked at me kind of weird, like, all right, fine. Yeah. And then Micah took the picture, and I said, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Hope you enjoy it. And Micah looked at Tess and goes, yeah, he's the one that painted it. And Tess turned around and goes, I love you. So Tess and I have been friends ever since. So.
Well, fast forward a few Cactus Cons later when it became Phoenix Con and actually moved to downtown. We were all there, and I think you, Lynn, had donated a Data as Sherlock Holmes painting, and they had it up there. Paul Cornell was actually doing the hosting for the auction. You weren't there for that particular convention, but Dave and Micah and I were all there
watching. Yeah, it was probably the year after, because I think the last one I went to was 2010, when I actually got engaged at the art auction, but that's a whole other story. But
that was also a fun art auction story. Yeah. But that's your story to tell more than mine. But it was funny because the painting went up and the bidding, you know, had started, and one guy looked like he might have had it sewn up, and Paul Cornell, just being sociable, was like, so what do you want to do with this painting? And he made some comment, whoever the bidder was, like, oh, it's going to be a great gag gift for my girlfriend. Ha ha ha. Immediately, both Dave and I think almost in unison, were like, that is not a gag gift.
No, it's not. So
I shot my hand up and was like, okay, whatever he's bidding, I want to outbid it. And wow. I think it was, God, 300? Something insane. Not that your artwork should go for 300, Lynn. I'm just saying.
Thank you.
More than I was prepared to spend at the time, but I was like, I'm not letting that guy have it. You know, I don't care what happens. And I think I made the crack. My wife's going to kill me when she finds out that I spent $300 on this, but I don't care. You know, it was, again, you're friends, so it's like, I'm not going to let this chump have it, you know, for a gag gift. Bullshit. Yeah. That doesn't happen. Again, pardon my French. But
if anybody's looking for a good gag gift, I'm more than happy to sell it.
Go with gag gifts extraordinaire, Lynn Workman.
Right.
No, And then I think Dave or Micah, one of them, heard me mention my wife's going to kill me, and they outbid me on it.
Yeah, it was me, because, yeah. I guess the thing is this, when he said it was going to be a gag gift, I was just highly offended, because it's a beautiful painting, I love Lynn's work, and I was like, oh, this is the stupidest friggin' thing I've ever heard, So when you shot your hand up and you outbid it, I was like, good, good. And then you said, my wife's going to kill me. And I'm like, no. And I looked at Mike and I was like, what do you want to do? And Micah's like, go ahead. And so I outbid Al, so that, if you weren't prepared to have to, pay that much for the painting, and I...
And my wife saw it later and she was like, oh, why didn't you just go ahead and bid?
Right.
Where were you? I needed you.
It's... It actually is in my studio to this day, it hangs in a place of honor right next to my Superman daily newspaper strip from 1978, and my Captain Marvel Filmation animation cell that has the original background painting. They're all here in a place of honor in my studio.
That's cool. Yeah, I remember that the last auction I went to, Tess Fowler had donated like an art print. And this bidding war got started on it. And I think, Dave, you, Micah, and Nikki came walking in during the middle of this bidding war. And this print, which she was selling for like 10, 15 bucks, at her table, the bidding got up over 100 bucks when you guys walked in.
Right.
And I think it got close to 200, if I'm not mistaken. It was like 180, 190, somewhere around there.
Yeah, I remember that. I was there for that. And even the auctioneer was like, I think the auctioneer was Ed. I think it was Ed.
Yeah, Harris it was
the time,
Ed.
And he was like, guys, you can go buy this for $25. What do you...
Yeah.
Not that we don't appreciate the bids, but guys.
Mm-hmm.
But, Tess is a phenomenal talent. There's
yeah.
I have a whole wall of her stuff on my... just outside my kitchen. It's like the Tess Fowler wall, pretty much. And, she's recently come into some real success with some... work for Vertigo, is it, or IDW, or she did Kid Lobotomy, and she's working on something else now, I think.
Every time I turn around, she's got something new that she's promoting, so it's really, really cool, because I remember I think one of the last times at San Diego, her stuff had been featured in Heavy Metal magazine, and she was doing a signing over there with is it Eastman that owns Heavy Metal now from Teenage Mutant?
Took it over, yeah. And Grant Morrison actually took it over for a bit.
Oh, really?
I think.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, this is back when Eastman.
Who better to take over Heavy Metal than Grant Morrison?
Yeah. It's crazy, but yeah, she's been really, really busy.
Our mutual friendship basically has turned into a mutual appreciation society, I think. So.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great, because I was. We'll get into. Show me other comics later, but I was really happy to see you and Steve, working together on stuff. But let me ask you real quick, how did you first get into comics?
When I was a wee kid, not even really able to read, I had two older sisters who read comics, which, gives the lie to the myth, oh, girls don't read comics. I got two older sisters, it'll prove you wrong. But as part of the formation of my upbringing because of that, most of what my sisters were reading were like Supergirl stories out of Superman Family, a lot of Betty and Veronica's, a fun Batman backup story called Rose and the Thorn, which was a kind of a hero slash villain with like a schizophrenic personality or a split personality type of thing, but it was mostly female characters. So I grew up with a real love of all things superheroine. And this was before I could even read. And it's like, yeah, I knew that Supergirl had a cousin named Superman, but who cares? those weren't the comics that I was exposed to when I was a kid. As I grew up and became a teenager and I started discovering George Perez and his mastery with a pencil and Starfire, I started reading superheroine stories for other reasons, but, six of one, half dozen of another. But I wouldn't say that I really became a comic book fanatic until... the Wolfman Perez Teen Titans run, Claremont and Cockrum and Byrne on X-Men. Those were the comics that I started reading, and I was like, okay, this is for me. This is this is the hill I will die on, and I never looked back. We had all the old issues of my sisters had, but until I started buying my own comics, which the very first comic I ever bought on my own was an issue of Black Panther back in the day, and it just mushroomed from there. I loved the medium, I loved the art, the storylines. School for me was one of those things I was always looking to escape from, and I had a comic that could let me do that, and it was always something that I always felt I could be content to just be a fan of. Flash forward about 30 years, I'm working with this guy from Ireland named Steve Reed, and he comes up and says, "Hey, I heard you liked comics. Well, I'm an artist and I want to draw something, and I need somebody to write something for me to draw." And it never really occurred to me. It's like, I'll write you a script because I've read enough of these damn things. I should be able to write it. And, we just came up with a little 6-page gag thing, and then that mushroomed into working on 10 issues now. I found I had kind of a... I'm not going to brag or anything and say I have a knack for it, but I enjoy doing it. I really enjoy the construction process of it. I found... What I enjoy more than anything, surprisingly, is lettering. I actually love lettering comics. Wow. I find that to be the most relaxing part of the whole thing because it's like solving a puzzle.
Well, people don't really realize that there is an art to doing lettering.
Yeah, I'm discovering it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Time. Well, so was that your first published work? Was Thugs?
Thugs was the first self-published work that I ever did. I think I had tried a hand at making a web comic for a while beforehand, but really it was just dipping my foot in the pool and seeing how everything kind of worked and how everything functioned. But it was when web comics were new and not everybody had one, and I'd since lost the files on it, so don't ask to see it because I have no idea where they are. They're buried on a hard drive somewhere. But the first real time that I actually got the stones to print something on paper, go get a table at a comic convention and put it out. Yeah, it was Thugs.
Wow. And, okay. No, I was going to say, what's the elevator pitch for Thugs then?
Thugs is basically what would happen if two ordinary henchmen got lucky and shot Batman and Robin and killed them. Okay. That's the elevator pitch. Obviously, I cannot go and kill Batman and Robin, but we can certainly make a parody of it. And we had the idea long before all these other upstarts like Garth Ennis and what have you came along and made better versions of it. But we had the idea that what if all the superheroes were assholes and, just not likable at all? They're human beings with human being failings. And we basically had these two henchmen who are working for the evil genius, and they go to steal this massively super powerful gun. And they get stopped by Batman and Robin, who in our version is Dark Cowl and the Finch. And the fun part about the Finch is he's the 37th Finch in a long line of Finches. We've all met with horrible demises in some way, usually at the hands of Dark Cowl's incompetence. Well, one thing leads to another, and it's an older henchman and his young ward, and the young ward accidentally shoots the superpowered gun and kills Dark Cowl and the Finch. So now you've got all the superheroes in the world out to avenge their fallen comrade, which the more you read of it, you realize none of them really like Dark Cowl anyway. Much like you can get that vibe that if Batman left the Justice League, how many people would really be disappointed, but there's that. And then you've also got the supervillains after them because they got shown up. It's bragging rights. These two schmucks that don't have any superpowers, don't have any real world ending desires, they killed Dark Cowl and the Finch? No, that will not stand. So everybody's after these two guys. So it turned into kind of a buddy comedy, and every now and then I throw the drama card in there to throw Steve off, and he counters by drawing the breasts bigger on Ultra Maiden each time. So, we have fun with it. I mean, we butt heads occasionally, which is fun and productive usually. It makes for a better comic. But, he's real good at finding stuff like, hey, you introduced this back in issue 3 and you haven't addressed it yet. Mm-hmm. And that goes back to the whole, this is seat of our pants writing. This is, it's kind of like Lost, where everybody accused you know, the people in Lost of making it up as you're going along. Yes. Yes, mm-hmm. We are pretty much making it up as we go along. And that's been fun. That's been exciting. But it also taught me a lot about, no, you got to have some kind of plan. Mm-hmm. You really need to have some kind of plan in mind for how things are going to go. Which is why I think I mentioned earlier, I'm working on issue 12, which is going to be the last issue in the series, now. So I know that I can bring everything full circle to give it a satisfying conclusion. Because that's, as a writer, that's always my big beef, is dropping the ball or not finishing it well. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't mean that I have to give everybody the ending that they wanted to see, but I have to give them a good ending. I have to give them something that makes sense. And, you know, we've all watched or read a book where you can tell the writing team just gave up or phoned it in or just said, okay, let's end it, you know. And I don't want to do that with this. This was the baby that brought me on board, so I don't want to send it out that way. And, right. You know, I learned enough of it so that when we started working on Red Skirts, Dave and I knew enough to go in and plan. And like, mm-hmm. okay, unlike with Thugs where we'll just, okay, and what happens next? And what happens next? And what happens next? I mapped everything out. I mapped everything out in this whole crazy thing that, you know, at the rate we're going, we'll have it done when we're in our 80s. So that should be good. And, you know, it's been a fun, different way of writing for each book, which has kept me on my toes. And, you know, it inspires a lot of the stuff that I'm working on my own, too. It's, mm-hmm. you know, what things can I bring into Twitch? What things can I bring into my elf story? What things can I bring into other stuff that mm-hmm. I've learned from this? You know, life is an ongoing educational process.
Right. So what was Barbara Berrien about?
Barbara Berrien was me going back to trying to do a webcomic and be consistent with it, and mm-hmm. I failed on the aspect of trying to be consistent with it. Mm-hmm. The trick to a good webcomic, for those of you who are interested in doing a webcomic, is consistency. If you tell everybody that you're going to have a webcomic every Wednesday, have a webcomic every Wednesday. And there are some creators who can get away with going even as far as a few months without publishing something. But if you're just starting out, you can't be that person. If you tell everybody there's going to be a comic, you need to have a comic. And I started out with all good intentions on this fun story that I had about, it happened right about the time my niece was born, and it was a girl, and she's a holy terror, and, you know, love her to death and everything. But the idea was, what if an 8-year-old girl got her soul taken over by a Nordic warrior? You know, an ancient one. And so she has a lot of anger management issues. She walks around with this helmet on the whole time, and it was another one where I was having fun creating it, and I wanted to see, at the time, at my tables at conventions, I was getting a lot of younger people coming up because my artwork tends to be kind of cartoonish. Mm-hmm. So I thought, can I create something that would be for them? And in the process of trying to create a kid's comic, eventually old me took over, and it just started evolving into, and now we'll bring in demons for her to slay, and all this other stuff, and it's like, you're not cut out to do kids' books, Al. Just accept it and move on. Find your own audience and all like that. Which is anyone will tell you, that's the trickiest part, is finding your own audience. And you know, kids weren't my audience. I thought that maybe it was something that it was, but it really wasn't. And you know, it helped to realize that. It helped to realize, okay, you know, kids like me to draw a little kiddie stuff for them, and that's fine to do. That's not the type of books I really want to create. That's not really the type of story that I want to tell. So, you know, that's how Barbara Berrien worked. And I've got the final issues, or the final strips, I should say, done. And we're going to finish it out before the end of the year. And then I'm going to revamp my website to focus on new artwork and stuff like that. I don't know that I'll ever do another webcomic, so to speak. It'll probably be more like what Red Skirts is, where it's a comic that's on the web. But right. don't hold us to a schedule. We'll put new pages up when we get them done. And that's probably how whatever I do next will be. But, yeah, it was a fun experiment. I enjoyed it. You know, a lot of people did pick up the book, but not kids, because, you know, they like looking at stuff, but I can't compete with Pokemon at the convention floor, and really I shouldn't want to try. So,
right.
You know, God bless the people who can find that kid audience and write great books that are for kids. It is a a definitely rewarding market to get into. It's just not the market that I really am suited to do.
Right. So what has, is there anything else that you've learned at conventions that you, you know, thought, oh, it's going to be this way, and then you got there and it was like, well, okay, I'm going to have to change my game plan here.
I learn something new at every convention I go to, and usually it's from watching the people around me. I have that horrible sense of insecurity that I think most artists can relate to, that, you know, everybody else knows what the hell they're doing and I don't. You know, just watching everybody around me, it's like, oh my God, they're all geniuses and I'm an idiot, you know, and I don't realize that they're probably looking at me going, look at what that guy's doing. That's pretty amazing. Neat. Mm-hmm. He really knows his stuff.
You know, it's interesting too, because that goes as far as like being, you know, one of the quote unquote big two creators as well. Because there's been quite a few shows I've set up at, and I've looked around and I've seen independent artists or other professionals setting up, and I'm like going, man, I really got to step up my game. I'm not doing this right, or I'm not doing that right. So yeah, definitely mm-hmm. looking around and seeing what other people are doing and learning from it. That's a huge thing.
The craziest thing I learned this past time, and it came from the convention before, the guy that was sitting up next to me had all of his prints out that he was selling, but he had them all pre-wrapped, pre-ready to go with a backing board, ready to go, and up on a nice vertical stand where people had to look at them and physically pull them out and touch them. And it turns out if you can get it in their hands, they're going to buy it.
Right, and yeah.
I used to go the old route where my prints were all in one of those big black portfolio books, and you could flip through and go, oh, I'd like that one, or oh, I'd like that one. Mm-hmm. Well, this year I didn't throw it away, but I just didn't bring the big black portfolio book. Or if I did, I filled it with original art for people to look through and get an idea of the kind of artwork that I do, and then when they're done flipping, I'd say, okay, would you like me to sketch something for you in that style, or something mm-hmm. like that. But the prints and everything in the books were all up where people could get their grubby little meat hooks on them.
Yeah, it seems like you really need to go vertical in a con situation, just because also people walking by, if you have anybody stopped in front of your table and they're looking at that black book, nobody else can see it. But if you've got stuff vertical, you know, as they're walking by, they can, you know, stuff will catch their eye and go, oh, wait a minute, and they can kind of look around those people if they have to.
And that was really, that's really true. And like with books, I always have reading copies. You know, I keep them separate so I can just spread them out. And it's like, yeah, flip through this. If you want a good one, it's already pre-bagged and bored. You have to invest a little bit more, I've discovered, in order to really sell more. You know, if you can get the book out there and actually get it in their hands, 9 times out of 10, that's all you need. Mm-hmm. You know, if they're looking at it and holding it in their hands and they're like, this is a really nice product, I was willing to actually pick it up and hold on to it. And then you tell them, yeah, it's $5. And they're like, oh, here's $5. Yeah, no problem. And, you know, you sign it and do whatever and all like that. And, you know, it's weird. This past Phoenix Con was kind of an iffy one. I don't want to go too deep into the problems that they had. They had a few, you know, and if you mm-hmm. follow them on social media, they're pretty well known. But I did okay. I did okay basically because I've started learning from watching other people. And, you know, I think that helps. I think it also helps to do a bad convention every now and then. I think it helps to go to a convention and just do awful. I've done a few of those where you're sitting around twiddling your thumbs going, nobody's buying anything. Nobody's even stopping to look. It's the worst feeling in the world, but mm-hmm. it's also the biggest kick in the butt you can have to be like, okay, I need to do something different.
Yeah, I've had a couple of those to where the artists and vendors outnumbered the attendees. And I ended up like trading art with like table neighbors and stuff like that. And yeah, it can be very humbling. And I've also learned too, having slow shows where I went to that was completely my fault that it was slow, was because I went back and I really didn't have anything new. You know, it's like it was the next year had come around and I went back with the same stuff. And they're like, wow, this is really cool. Have you got issue 4 out? No, I don't have issue 4 out yet. Okay. Do you have any new prints? No, I don't have any new prints out yet. Oh, do you? Okay. And they're willing to buy, but I didn't, you know, they'd already bought all the other stuff I brought last year. So sometimes if you don't have new stuff, it's almost better to kind of skip a year.
And, yeah.
You know, maybe just go as an attendee and walk around and see everybody and chat and all that. But definitely setting up when you don't have anything new to sell is a bad thing, at least for me. Well, Al, you mentioned earlier about the creepy and the eerie magazines and all that. I was one of those weird kids that actually got into those. And I remember seeing Bernie Wrightson for the first time in one of those black and white magazines. But one of the other magazines I remember seeing as a kid, too, was Cartoons Magazine. So tell me, when was the first time you found out about Cartoons Magazine, and how did you come about working with it?
Dave actually approached me and said, hey, I have a gig and I need a writer. I had heard of cartoons, but I'm not a gearhead by any stretch of the imagination. Mm-hmm. A sports car is wasted on a guy my size. So, you know, I appreciate the look of a Lotus, but I could never afford to own one. And if I did, it would be a waste. I am not so mechanically inclined, or I don't like to drive fast. My wife will attest that I'm the slowest driver on the road. So, you know, stuff like that is wasted on me. I love my truck, and I will probably own that truck until the day I die. So I might not be the best person as far as the readership for cartoons, but always more than happy to you know, step into unfamiliar territory. I had heard of cartoons back in the day, but I certainly never bought an issue of it. I just knew it existed, and I was aware of it. But it was really neat that these guys were trying to bring it back and resurrect it. And, mm-hmm. you know, there are certainly tons of people who love cars, and they were really excited to see this come back. And so it was kind of fun, given that they wanted particular themes each issue out of us. Like, the very first one was, I think, a horror-themed one. And I was like, oh, you can totally have fun with that. You know, the whole Rat Fink, Hearstmobile type thing. And
Back from the Dead was the theme.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I mean, that was just a lot of fun to write, because it gave Dave a chance to draw kind of an Elvira-type character, and I got to make some Dracula jokes and all kinds of fun like that. And, you know, each one got to be its own fun little vignette. Like, we did one that was a like an auto show, and that was actually a lot of fun. I don't know it. Did that one take the longest for you to do, Dave? Because I know it was more pages.
Yeah, that issue was tough because I had something I had to do in Vegas, I think, where the deadline fell. And I was, like, literally sketching and taking pictures with my phone because I did the back cover ad or whatever for that issue, too. Which, it wasn't really an ad. It was like a, I don't know, it was like a pinup type thing for the back cover. We did the most, I think, for that issue, and that was actually issue one. That had the car show in it with sort of a Ed Sullivan type character, and that one was really fun. I don't remember what the, I think the theme for that one was hot rods, because that's the end gag, is the guy's got the hot rod. So
yeah. Well, and then the other one we did was kind of a muscle car themed one where we just mimicked Starsky and Hutch.
The Big Red Tomato?
That's one where I was like, you know, we ought to just make this a book. This could almost work, because we had every stereotype in there. The angry black chief of police, you know, guy yelling at him, which I think was a staple in Starsky and Hutch. We had the oversexed fellow detective cop, you know, whose only job seemed to be going, you guys be careful out there, you know, instead of, you know, mm-hmm. actually doing so. It was the 70s, and we were horrible to everybody, and I think we really caught that we were horrible to everybody vibe, to be honest.
Yeah,
and
we did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think of any of them, that's the one that I chuckle the most at, but also kind of like go, wow, okay. All right, sure.
And to give a little bit of context to Cartoons Magazine, it had, I think, originally publication was like sometime in the 1950s, I think around 1951, 1952, and it was continuous publication, I think, until like the mid to late 1990s, when it kind of went under, or ceased mm-hmm. publication. And then several years ago, Mark Marthod, I hope I'm saying his name right, he actually managed to secure the rights to bring Cartoons Magazine back. And there was a whole bunch of us on, like, the Cartoons page on Facebook that we're talking about. I'm a huge Sean Carey fan, and I love Cartoons Magazine growing up. Some of my earliest drawing lessons were actually stuff that George Trosley was doing actually in Cartoons Magazine. So I grew up with a lot of that, you know, Crass and Bernie and Corvette and all of those features from the 80s. And the magazine, too, besides just focusing on, like, muscle cars and hot rods, it also focused on things like four-wheel drive trucks and motorcycles and all kinds of different kinds of vehicles. And our initial thing we pitched for the magazine was actually going to be a recurring feature that I was really excited about. And I'm at some point here, I'm going to talk to Al about it because I still want to do that because I still think that could be really great. But we may do it like as our own separate thing. But
it could be a backup feature for Red Skirts.
Exactly. So just but that's just a little bit of context. It's kind of Mad Magazine. It's humor, all ages humor. It's still in publication. They eventually managed to get into Diamond.
And I see it at Walmart a lot.
Yeah, well, they were with a magazine distributor, but the problem is there's a lot of turmoil in that magazine distribution channel, which they used to call the old newsstand distribution channel. There are a lot of challenges to that. Most publications could not survive in that channel because of how it works and loss versus profit and returnable versus non-returnable product. And there's a lot of challenges with the newsstand as a business model. And just for me personally, I would recommend anyone who's looking at doing a magazine, seriously look at digital distribution and look at other channels first before you try and wade into newsstand, because it'll break your back if you're not careful.
Because I was picking up Cosplay magazine at like Target, and then it's gone away. I haven't seen it there anymore. So I don't know if they're still publishing or if they're just doing digital only or what. I have to figure that out. So.
Well, there's this romantic idea like that everyone has, because a lot of us grew up buying magazines on the magazine stand. But I'm going to be honest with you, that space is not what it once was. And if you can find a way, and I know this doesn't sound as fun, but if you can find a way to, you know, figure out who your market segment is, how to target them directly, and how to deliver the product directly to them digitally as well as print, either through a subscription-based service through the web or, you know, through a different distribution channel. I would actually recommend Diamond over the newsstand distribution channel. You know, I would definitely encourage people to go that route because it's just there's just a lot of challenges with that particular space.
Right. Yeah, because I know the CGS guys tried it for a little bit and they got a few issues out, and then they had to stop doing it. So I'm sorry. Go ahead, Al.
No. That's one thing I was going to bring up. I was going to say a lot of those. Books like the one I'm trying to create, like Creeps and Tomb is another one, Kickstarter or crowdsourcing in some form, they're going that route quite a bit. And you know, it's kind of nice because if you get enough people to back you, you can keep your cost down. Like I think an issue of Creeps cost me a whopping $7 to get, which, you know, considering how much they cost back in the 70s, sure, but this isn't the 70s anymore. $7 is a steal.
Right.
For what they're doing. And, you know, he's able to actually put himself in Diamond as well because he's got the numbers that Diamond will say, oh, okay, he's got enough that we can actually put this out. Okay, great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, the Diamond conversation is conversation for another time, and I wonder how that's changed.
Sure.
It has to have changed from when we were doing it, because I just can't imagine anyone's able to do the numbers that they wanted out of us on the independent side, you know, let alone, you know, back in the day. I don't know.
Well,
I don't know.
I'm amazed when I'm not a big numbers junkie. You know, I know John Mayo and like John Jackson Miller, you know, you can ask them and they can ramble off numbers to you all day long if you want. But I've heard some of the numbers for some of the big two books lately, and I'm like, that's not much more than what we were doing independently, you know, several years back.
Right.
So numbers have dropped on a lot of them.
Well, and that's the thing I always thought was funny, because at the time when we were doing Bushytails, I didn't think we were doing that great. But when I'm hearing some numbers being discussed right now, I'm like, we would be doing really good right now. So
Well, let's get into to Red Skirts. Since I'm an outside observer, I'll let Al, you and Dave explain to us how you two came up with the Red Skirts.
Don't have lunch with me. That's the main rule with Red Skirts. Dave and I did an in-store at a store way out in Mesa, Arizona. And when it got done, I was like, hey, let's go have dinner or something before you have to drive back to... He lives a good distance away. I was like, let's go have lunch somewhere. So we went and had lunch and just the usual conversation about comics we love and artists we like and blah, 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 and ideas that we have. And Dave said, you know, I've got an idea floating around in my head, and it's just two words right now, and I can't figure out what to do with it, but it'd be like a science fiction thing, and we call it Red Skirts. And I think I said, stop right there. I spit out my meat, and I was like, stop, because you have struck gold. Just let me work on this, and let me write this, because already the ideas, it's like creative diarrhea in your head. Just the ideas are just flying out of my head, and I'm like, you've got to give me a shot at this. And Dave's like, yeah, okay. And he kind of had that look like, what the hell have I done? You know, but I
went home. Much like your wife after she said, I do, right?
Yeah, pretty close. She was like, oh, God, I've made a horrible mistake. I got home, and I just started writing. And I swear, every character just kind of flowed out like, oh, my God, this. And then we can do 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 this. And then this could happen. And I think Dave was like, yeah, he'll send me a few pages with some rough ideas for what the characters are. And I think by the time I was done, it was about 70 pages worth of backstory and ideas. And then this could happen. And then we could do this and this. And I mean, I was just totally on board with this idea. And the idea was simply, it's a love letter that Dave and I have to all the shows that we watch growing up. That's pretty much the pitch I give people at conventions is... If you grew up watching Star Trek, Star Wars, Space 1999, Buck Rogers in the 25th Century, even the older Buster Crabbe, Flash Gordon, or you know, any of that stuff, all those great science fiction shows, V, Alien Nation, everything that we watched growing up, there's elements of it in this story. And you can't deny the obvious Trek influence because it's the Red Skirts, and the outfits are not far removed from the standard Star Trek lieutenant uniform, but at the same time, you know, there's so many other elements into it, and as we've worked on it, it's become its own beast. You know, what started out as something that's like, here's a tribute to all these great things we loved growing up, well, now it's kind of been graduating away from it, and like, no, here's its own thing. Here's this thing that's kind of standing on its own two feet now, and you know, it's always great at conventions because I'll see people in Starfleet uniforms and all I have to do is hold the book up and they're kind of like, ooh, what's this? You know, and that's usually enough to get them hooked because once they open the book and find the pages that I haven't covered with all my letters over Dave's artwork, it's enough to get them in. And, you know, they've come back and asked, okay, now where's issue two? Now where's issue three? And, you know, I give them the whole spiel about stuff that we're planning and what we plan to do with it, and they're on board. They love it. I mean, I think the most telling thing was we had a cosplayer before we ever had the first issue.
Right.
Wow.
That was shocking.
We had a few pages up on the web. You know, as I think I mentioned earlier, we decided to approach this not as a webcomic, like I said, where if you say every Wednesday you're going to have a page, you better have a page. No, this is just a comic on the web. This is something where when we get it done, we're going to put up a new page for you. And, you know, that served us a lot better because, you know, when Dave gets a paying gig or what have you, I want him to focus on that. It's helpful to be able to pay your air conditioning bill and all like that. So certainly, you know, we've had a few hiccups along the way where we've had to slow production down and everything like that, but it's understandable. You know, it's a labor of love for both of us, and if people are really enjoying it, which they seem to be, more's the better. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it's got to be something fun for me. It's got to be something fun for Dave to do.
Right, because I know that I've heard a few interviews with Mike Norton and talking about his Little Donnie web comic strip. And it's gotten syndicated, which is great, but now he's like, well, damn, I've got to keep drawing this thing.
Yeah.
It started off as something therapeutic, which I was really proud of him because, you know, whichever way you lean, you know, in the elections and politically or whatever, once the elections were over, all my friends that were super, super creative, you know, quit posting artwork. You know, they started just, you know, posting, you know, just ramblings about how bad this, you know, opponent was, this or this, you know, politician is and that. And all the really cool art just kind of went away. And I'm sitting here thinking, well, come on, guys, you know, 'cause I am not political by any means. I've done a few political cartoons back, oh God, back in the 90s when I was doing stuff for the Rock 103 site. But I kept waiting for somebody to, you know, use their creativity and have something cool come out of this situation. And Mike was like one of the few people that I saw actually take, you know, what he was feeling and put it into a creative outlet and came up with this comic strip. And now he's getting, you know, all kinds of nominations for like Eisner's and Rubens and stuff like that. But he's like, I hate having to draw it now. You know, he goes, I'm sick of this guy. And but he said, you know, he's in it. He said, as long as he's in office, he'll be drawing it.
So. It sounds kind of like Radiohead, the band, no longer playing Creep mm-hmm. in their concerts, because it's like, yeah, it's a song everybody knows us for, but God, we hate it. So,
right,
yeah.
I think REM was the same way about Radio Free Europe. It's like, we're not going to play it. Don't ask us to. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't like playing it anymore, so.
Yeah. That's why I won't do Beth in concert anymore. I'm just tired.
You're done. Yeah. I'm done with
it. I'm done. Yeah. I've done it. I've done it every way.
But yeah, I mean, I'm glad, though, that with Red Skirts, we didn't commit ourselves to, you know, every... We're going to have a new page every Wednesday. Well, you know, mm-hmm. if you see what goes into making some of these pages, you know, and living a daily life as well, you know, there's a lot that goes into them. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of an unrealistic expectation.
Well, and the way that to talk craft for just a minute, the way that I'm approaching the art on Red Skirts is a hybrid of all the different things I've done over the years. So we're using CGI for a lot of the backgrounds, a lot of the props and the planets and that kind of stuff. It all sometimes gets like a pretty heavy-handed, like paint over kind of here and there sometimes when I get kind of what I want, but I change my mind or I decide there's a different way to approach it. So there's kind of, but there's a heavy CGI element. And then all the characters they're all drawn by hand and they're kind of rendered in a style that's kind of like cell shading. So ideally it's like kind of like a cartoon. And part of that, going back to Bushytail's, Lynn, was kind of the way we had talked about doing that Bushytail's Adventures book years ago. And right. I was thinking, it's like, well, here's an opportunity to figure that look out and at the same point, you know, kind of work in the way I've always wanted to, because you can, if you're smart, you can save some time using CGI backgrounds. But sometimes the way I'm approaching Red Skirts, I'm not really saving a lot of time, but I think I'm kind mm-hmm. of improving the quality of what it would be otherwise. Because there's not a lot of shortchanging in the backgrounds. So, and there's not a lot of shortchanging in the figure work either. So, mm-hmm. you know, the storytelling is there and the script is there, you know, it kind of, helps to put together like a really solid, book at the end of the day, but it's very much an outgrowth of the way I've wanted to do comics for like a long time, but there's no way in the world a publisher would have allowed me to experiment and kind of create the look for Red Skirt that it currently has. And that has a lot to do with the influences and what I wanted to try and suggestions that Al had for certain things and in terms of the look and the approach. And it's funny.
I kept it minimal. I think I just said draw the Bratz girls or something like that.
You kept going on and on about Monster High. So.
That too, yeah.
But go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. No, that was just a basic look that was. I don't know that it was popular at the time, but it just seemed like something when I looked at it, I was like, this is how this book ought to look.
Right.
And you know, it's. I didn't want us to follow a trend. I didn't want us to. You know, oh, well, this is what everybody else is doing. But at the same time, when I looked at it, I was like, this is just cartoony enough and just serious enough that if Dave can approach this particular style, that'll give this book the tone it needs to have.
Right. And then I kind of...
I think that...
Go ahead.
What? We keep interrupting. I'm going to stop. You go.
Well, all I was going to say is that I interjected. I'm a big fan of Brett Blevins, and I love the way that he does his female characters. And there's some similarities there between kind of the Monster High look and what Brett does. So I tried to kind of fill in the gaps stylistically, making choices like I thought Brett would make, you know, so that, and at the end of the day, it doesn't really look like anything. It just looks like its own thing, and that's really cool.
Yeah, that is really the fun part of it, and something that I think a lot of people, at least at conventions, you know, it's eye-catching. It really does. Mm-hmm. Even if they don't pick up the book, they stop and ask about it. Because they're like, well, what is this about? You know, and I give them the spiel. And if they're not science fiction people, they're probably not going to pick it up. But even still, I've had a few that are like, well, this doesn't sound like my cup of tea, but I like the look of it. I'm gonna pick this up and give it a shot. And you know, I think that artwork goes a long way to bringing that home.
That's great.
Well, and it's great. And it's an important thing for you know, people out there that are thinking about creating a comic or are currently working on a comic. It's important to understand this very basic concept. The art is good for attracting attention and creating desire for people to go, oh, I want to try this or I want to read this. But at the end of the day, one of the really, really big selling points is always going to be the story. It's always going to be the writing. It's going to be the script, because that's what brings people back. So when you're thinking about your comic or your webcomic or whatever you're creating, you always have to bear in mind you can use the art to bring them in, but if you really want to hook them and you want to keep them around, the story has to be there too.
Right. Yeah, the old thing is artists sell issue one, writers sell issue two.
Well, what has kept you guys wanting to do this? What has been the fun aspect of it?
You want to go first, Dave, or me?
I mean, if you want, I'll jump in, because I'll try to keep it quick.
Okay.
Because you're really the guest in this episode, not me.
Because I won't keep it quick.
I'll be quick.
Go ahead.
So for me, the thing I love about Red Skirts is the freedom, and the fact that I get to play in an arena that I've loved since I was a really little kid. Whenever I sit down and work on Red Skirts, I always think about when I was, I don't remember exactly how old I was, 6, 7, 8 years old. I don't remember exactly. I'm really bad with dates, but I was a little kid. And way back when, movie theaters, they used to do those marathon, like all day movie marathons. And they would play a whole bunch of films back to back to back. And my mom is a huge fan of science fiction. Part of the reason I draw is because I used to watch my mom draw. And the first time I was ever inspired to draw at all was because my mom was doing a watercolor painting of Spock while Star Trek was on TV. And I was like, oh, this is so awesome. I was like, I want to do this. And so she sat me down with some crayons and some notebook paper, and I started drawing. And that's how I started drawing, is watching my mom paint Spock. And then she took me to one of those all-day movie marathons. And they were playing Star Crash. They played Flash Gordon, the two-hour movie version of Battlestar Galactica. Not Saga the Star Wall, but the original two-hour-like version that they released in theaters. The two-hour Buck Rogers in the 25th Century, the one that was supposed to be a movie before it ended up coming to TV.
Yeah, that has the groovy, sexy credit opening.
Yes, exactly. The really crazy, trippy.
YouTube it. If you don't know what we're talking about, but it's great. The intro to the original Buck Rogers is wowza.
With lyrics, no less.
Yeah, with lyrics. That song had a theme. Yeah, it had lyrics to it.
It's a little cringy, but it's interesting. that we saw that. And I remember the big new movie that was the thing that was playing at the end of this marathon was Battle Beyond the Stars, which is basically the Magnificent Seven or the Seven Samurai in space. And I have loved all of those movies ever since then. And to be able to work on something where I get to kind of embrace that love of things like that, and like the Disney movie The Black Hole, and Last Starfighter, and of course Star Wars. And so whenever I get to sit down, there's so much freedom, and I look at what Al's put on the page, and I go, okay, this is cool, and it turns into, what can I put in the background? what fun thing can I throw in here if someone's paying attention? And then there's
thankfully there's more, oh, this is cool, as opposed to, good God, Al, what are you thinking?
No, I love, and I guess that's the thing. It's like when I read this 70-page treatment that Al sent with the backstory and a lot of information on the characters and everything, my initial thought was like, wow, this is a lot of material. But then my second thought was, this could be really awesome. This could be really cool. And then the more I worked on it, I fell in love with it. And I love all the characters, and I love the setting and the environment. And then there's the silly things I started doing just for fun. I started drawing pets into the book, because initially it was fun. We had a tribunal scene, and where Mary's on trial, Ensign Meredith Mary, who's the main character of Red Skirts, she's on trial for something that she's done, and there's a tribune, just like classic Star Trek, you know, with the three officers who are sitting in judgment or whatever. And so we needed the three, and Al wanted them to be in shadow where you couldn't see who they were. But the way that the book is put together, shadows like that are not really going to work. Because just the way I designed it, it just wouldn't look right. And every time I tried to mess with it, it's just the blacks were too heavy-handed, and it's like, this is not going to work. And so I was going, okay, what kind of cool characters can we do? So I did like a really fun 1950s, like, you know, one-eyed tentacled creature, you know, and he's in like a, you know, the GGC. The GGC is our version of the Starfleet, the GGC uniform. And then I'm like, okay, I need another guy. And I was like, oh, well, one of my favorite sort of guys who's always sitting in judgment of other people's, if you used to watch Coast to Coast, was Zorak.
Yep.
So I did a version, like my version of a Zorak kind of looking character who's on one end. And I needed the guy who was in charge. And I started thinking about it. And the thing I kept coming back to is, I was like, it needs to be something kind of endearing, because it would be kind of funny to be kind of off-putting if he's being really hard, you know, kind of hard-nosed about it. So I drew my dog Kirby, and
so you made him cold nosed.
Yes, exactly. So it was kind of funny, and I got done with it, and I just loved it, and I was like, this is so much fun. And so as we went on, I kept putting more and more stuff in, and being more and more with the characters, and I was at Emerald City last year. Ed Harris, who keeps coming on with the show, we need to get Ed on the show. Ed arranged for me to get to go out there and hang out with him, and I got to meet my art hero, Jose Luis Garcia Lopez. But I also had a bunch of pages from Red Skirts and character designs, and I was walking around showing them to people, just kind of getting some feedback and seeing how people react to it. And the reactions from everyone I showed it to was really strong, and people just loved the fact that there were, you know, dogs and cats and, you know, crazy looking aliens and all these kind of fun things. And so I'm just totally in love with the book and what we're doing. So again,
well, thanks for the short answer.
Yeah, I know. I was just thinking, this is long story longer again.
That's what we're going to read in the podcast.
Yeah, long story longer.
Yeah,
that's good.
All right, Mr. Al, you have the floor.
Well, you know, I'll try and be brief for a change. For me, it's really, the fun of these characters. I mean, as a writer, if you can find characters that you can really get into and enjoy the stories behind them and have them really well developed, they become fun to write. They become fun to just do it. It's really awkward for a 49-year-old man to tell you that, oh, I love writing in the character of, you know, however old these girls are, you know, or these young women, I should say. And it's just, they're so much fun to write, though. There's so much about them, and I guess I do a good job because a lot of Red Skirts fan base is female. You know, the people who come up and do cosplay obviously are pretty much female. I did get a request one time to do a commission of a guy drawn as a Red Skirt, which I happily did. But you know, we get a lot of feedback.
Was that John Berriman?
No.
and there must be heels.
He would probably go for that. Yes. Yeah. If we could get John Berriman to endorse Red Skirts, that would be awesome. But no, I mean, every character has such a fun backstory that, you know, I talk to people at our conventions about, you know, I really like this character. You know, what are your plans for her? And, you know, these characters, unlike with Thugs, where with Thugs we're doing obvious parodies so I can go over the top with it. With some of these characters, it's no, these people have a history, and there has to, you have to be, you have to keep that in perspective. You have to be like, she wouldn't say that, or he wouldn't do that, or, you know, what have you. And that's really how you should be with all your characters, but with Red Skirts, for some reason, it's just, I realize that these characters, you hear, like, bigger, much bigger names than me talk about other characters don't really belong to them anymore. That's kind of how I am with these. You know, other people are coming and saying, you know, I really like Shiva. Please don't do this. Or,
right.
You know, don't do that. And it's like, I just give them the duly noted, knowing full well what I plan to do with them. So, you know, the decisions have already been made. But, you know, it's great that people respond that way. And it's really fun to just, you know, they always say kill your darlings. Anything that you get too attached to, don't be afraid to let it go. Well, you know, we're not killing these girls off. They're Unit 3D. They're women who can stand on their own. They don't need any kind of approval to achieve what they do. They've survived as long as they have because they learn to rely on each other, because they learn to depend on each other to achieve what they need to. And it's great. Every one of them has a flaw. I've built, like, character flaws into each and every one of them. Mary, if you read through this whole first episode, has an element of power adds to her. She's on trial because she released an unknown life form onto the deck of a massive starship, quote, to see what would happen. You know, so, you know, her interest in science supersedes her interest in humanity, and that is because she's a fat-grown human. Her mom and dad were brilliant geneticists, and they decided that when they wanted to have a kid, well, let's grow one. Let's not have one. Let's build one. And so they built her from all the most amazing science, which I based her off the Doctor from Deep Space Nine, where they had a great episode where it turns out he's the genetic amalgamation of every great doctor that came before him.
Right.
You know, and so there was that element to it, and I'm like, that's kind of where the grain of an idea for her came. It's like, well, what if we took all the great scientists of the world and tried to amalgamate them, make an uber scientist? And so with her, science is everything, and, you know, that's going to come to an interesting end here in the next few pages of the book. So, you know, for those of you who still haven't read it online and you need to, www.redskirtsonline.com. Definitely check it out. But to me, it's world building, it's creation building, it's character building, it's everything that you get into writing for. You know, like I said, it started out as, hey, here's a labor of love and a love letter to all these wonderful shows we love growing up. But now it's its own thing. These characters are alive in my mind. They have souls, they have histories, they have futures ahead of them, and it's just going to be an interesting trip.
So, Al, as someone who has written quite a bit now, what advice would you give to anybody that wants to write comics and get into the business, or just, you know, doing a webcomic of their own?
Don't. Oh, I'm kidding. I say that every time because I've had that question asked to me before, and there's a great movie called The Decline of Western Civilization Part 2, The Metal Years. Mm-hmm. And they ask Dave Mustaine of Megadeth. I'm sorry, people are now crucifying me because I said Dave Mustaine was Motorhead. He's Megadeth. You know, he's the lead guitarist, right. Lead songwriter, everything.
And formerly Metallica. Yes,
formerly Metallica, and a rather famous metal story. But they ask him flat out, "What advice do you have for people who want to start a metal band and start a career in rock and roll?" And he just looks at her, "Don't." And I was like, "That's brilliant. There you go." In all seriousness, if this is what you want, if this is what you think you want to do, the best advice I can give, write every day. Right. Make sure that you know, you're not just making time to write. It should be the focus. Yeah, I have a day job that I do. It pays the bills very nicely. I'm good at it, so they tell me. I would never give it up for anything because I'm one of those rare birds who gets to do what I enjoy and what I was trained to do in life. So, you know, it's rare that you actually get to say that in life. At the same time, there's nothing I look forward to more in my day than lunch hour because I get to sit and sketch. And when I get home and I can kick back and add a few more paragraphs or pages to stuff that I'm working on. Yeah, it's the old work to live, don't live to work. Now, that's one element of it. Some people, God bless them, are talented and amazing enough they make their living. And if that's your goal, then take everything I said and multiply it by 10. You need to be, every single day, you need to be creating something. Even if it's dreck, you know, write bad fan fiction. Write stuff that you're actually working on and hoping to publish for somebody. Work with an artist. Work with somebody who's going to keep you at your game. You know, that you're responsible to. Otherwise, if you're just writing for yourself, you know, when I talk about how I'm working on you know, Twitch and stuff like that, I'm doing that for myself. So the only person cracking the whip on me is me. When I work on Red Skirts and Thugs, there's somebody else waiting for stuff from me. So that gives you a little kick in the butt. So it can be helpful to find an artist, maybe someone who is also up and coming, and work with them. You'll keep each other honest as far as, you know, getting your stuff in and getting it done. Don't get discouraged. It's easy to do that because writing is a very insular type of thing where you're spending your all day hunched over a word processor or a typewriter looking at a blank piece of paper and repeating the F word over and over and over again. I didn't come up with that one. I forget who came up with the original quote, but there's something like that. But you know, it's just something that if it's something you want, you have to put in the hours. You really do. You know, there's always going to be somebody who has put in more hours than you, but there's always going to be somebody who's put in less hours. So I guess stop comparing yourself to those people. The only person you're really in competition with is yourself. Listen to your audience, but at arm's length. Rather famously, you know, we got some fan mail from somebody for Red Skirts early on, and I made the mistake of responding, and they turned it out to be turned. Also, learn how to use proper grammar. That's
key. They spell also, check is your friend, yeah.
Spell check, well, they're spell check for open speech. There you go, yeah. But, you know, I made the mistake of responding to them, saying, oh, thank you for the kind words. Well, that was the opening for them to go complete psycho on me, and, you know, so be careful if you get even a crumb of fame, because the weirdos are out there. So just be careful of that, and, you know, lesson learned, definitely. So now when people are like, hey, I really enjoyed Red Skirts, I just have a mechanical head. Thank you. That's pretty much all. It's pretty much going to get. Sorry. You know, I'm not going to discuss the particulars of it. But, you know, it's something that is the greatest thing in the world when someone comes back for issue two, or you see someone show up dressed up as a character that you created, you know, that before then only existed in your mind or in Dave's pen or any of that kind of stuff. You know, when you see somebody that is that invested in it, when you have people not just asking but demanding, where's the next issue, when can I buy more of this stuff, you know, what have you. It's That's ultimately, if you wanna to get into comics, that's the good side of it. The bad side is the nonstop hours of no, I can't go do this. No, I don't want to go do this because I really need to put in some time writing. You know, don't. It's hard for me to sit and say don't do this, don't do that, don't do the other thing, because everything works differently for everybody else. But there has to be an element of just putting in the hours, just sitting down and, you know, sitting at your whatever writing program you use, or sitting at the art table. You have to put the time in, and that's the unfortunate but good side of it too. I don't know what else I could add. Don't get discouraged when you make mistakes, because you're gonna, right. I guess.
I have a suggestion. I was just going to say, one of the things that makes Al unique is that he actually letters. And so, for example, like on Red Skirts, Al is the letter on Red Skirts. I think, didn't you letter some of our cartoon stories?
I might have, yeah. And that was basically to help you out so you could do the art charts and focus on that. But it worked because, A, I discovered, oh my God, I love lettering. And that's a weird thing to hear people say. I think I don't know if you guys ever met Ben Ding, but his first comment was, oh, you're one of those people. But a writer, you know, Dave brings up a really good point. If you can learn the craft of lettering, the advantage we have is I wrote the dreck that I can edit when I'm lettering. So it's like, oh, God, what hack wrote that? Well, we're going to change that line so it'll fit a little better here and make more sense. It allows you the freedom to work on the fly and change stuff, but it also gives you an idea of, how artwork itself works. You know, if Dave does some panels where, you know, there's so much going on that I'm like, where am I going to fit what I wrote in here? That's not really a reflection on Dave. That comes back to me as the writer. Mm-hmm. Because it's like, you wrote it. You told him this is what you wanted. So now what are you going to do, tough guy? So it helps me as a writer to go back and go, wait a minute, if I've got this going on, then I really need to give Dave room to do this.
Right.
You know, so that I can come back and letter it. So
I remember working with Dave, on the Bushytails comic. There was a time when I was lettering the book, and I thought, this right here needs a pause. You know, this we need a panel that says nothing, and then let's move this one, word balloon or this thought balloon or caption, whatever. I think it was a caption. Let's move it over here to this last one. Let's end the page on this. And I was able to email it to Dave both ways, with JPEG saying, okay, here it is this way and here it is that way. Which do you think? And he was like, yeah, let's put the pause. So, yeah, just knowing where to put the balloons can affect the story.
And that is something I'm learning as well, is you can do as much with lettering by not lettering a single panel. Mm-hmm. As you can with making sure there's lettering on every page. You know, sometimes the best thing you can do as both a writer and as a letterer is to get out of the artist's way and let them do the work. Let them do the heavy lifting, and that's something you only learn over time. I'm trying to think of who were masters at that. Like John Byrne and Claremont would do that quite a bit, and Claremont's notorious for overwriting stuff, but he also knew when to shut up and just let Cockrum or whatever do panels that, showed Wolverine's expression or showed Kitty Pryde or Storm, what the hell just happened, and you saw it in the art.
Right.
You didn't have to have a panel overhead going, Storm was shocked by what had just happened. You didn't have to. You showed up on the panel.
Right. It was the artist's job to show you what had happened. Right.
Yeah.
And and ideally, the with comics as well as like TVs and movies and other visual forms of storytelling, ideally you want to show, not say. But the thing that I've found really interesting and I'm really enjoying about working on Red Skirts is because he is lettering it, it's not just the concept of I don't have to do that, but that is nice. But the other thing I really like about it is it gives, like Al mentioned earlier, it gives him the opportunity that once he sees the final page, he can adjust. Certain things that are, I can sometimes make more clear through body language, or I can make more clear through how the story is paced or progresses, like in terms of like the panel transitions. There's it kind of heightens certain things, sometimes minimizes certain things. But it's always interesting to see what Al does with it, because he will tweak it after he sees the final art. So it makes it, in my mind anyway, it makes it a stronger page, because Al is going in and he's kind of making the final edits on the script stage. And one of the things that Al does really well is Al is really, really good at scripting. He writes the characters incredibly well. And I've not been fortunate enough to be in this kind of position where the writer can kind of come in after, because other times it ends up happening is if you try to make something clear, it's double stated. The body language is there, but because it's on the scripted page, the letterer puts it in, and it's like double entendre is not the right expression, but it's
repetitive.
It's just like, well, wow, that was just said twice. That's stupid, you know? But what Al can do is, because he's the writer and because he's lettering, if it's there, it gives him the opportunity to change it or have something, a character say something that might even be the opposite of what the action is. You know, like they always talk about like what a character does versus what a character thinks is different, you know, as in terms of like real people and how people really act. So I was just going to mention that because I think that's a tremendous thing that has kind of come out of the process of doing Red Skirts that I think is really beneficial. And if you're doing an independent book, if you are the writer, seriously think about lettering the book yourself, because it gives you the opportunity to help craft the story on an even higher level, you know, once the art actually comes in. And I think that's really strong.
And there is a really cheap point of entry to learning to letter. Richard Starkings of Comicraft wrote a wonderful book that shows you the very basics that you would need to know, and I think it's a whopping $10. And you know, Starkings of Elephant Men and countless other books that his group does the lettering on, you have no doubt read them if you read any comics. You know, it's a great place to get your start. Every year for New Year's, Comicraft runs a sale on their fonts, and I always pick up 2 or 3. You know, and that's another side to it. If you're going to be professional about making comics, buy your fonts, don't steal them. You know, make sure you're playing above the board. You're helping out other artists. It's just good form. But yeah, it really is. Like, you know, we're getting ready to wrap up episode one and do a print version of it in some way, shape, or form that we will figure out. But before we do, I want to go through page by page, because how I was lettering this book on page one is not how I'm lettering now. And I want a consistent look all the way across the board. And there are a few pages I look at, and as a writer, I just cringe because it's like, wow, I buried a lot of artwork under a lot of words that don't need to be there. So it's kind of nice to have that freedom and that power, because, as Dave said, you don't always, because sometimes with comics, the writer does the writing, then the artist, then it goes to a letterer, then it goes to a colorist, and what have you. And you know, for a while there on Red Skirts, I was helping lay the flat colors out for Dave, and yeah, I have nothing but respect for colorists, because that is a road that I just dread taking every time. I'm still debating whether my elf story will be in color or not, just because I don't know if I want to put the effort in.
Well, another thing too with going to print after you've had stuff on the web, you know, you're able to see it before you go to print, because that was, you know, as soon as you go to print with something and you get it back in your hands, that's when you're going to see your mistakes. That's when you're going to see, oh man, it really didn't flow like I thought it did. Because you knew what it should say in your mind and what it actually says on the page, you know, spelling wise or just pacing wise, can be completely different. So yeah, being able to go back and go, yeah, Dad, maybe I'll tweak this lettering. That sounds good.
Yeah, basically with any of my caption panels in the early ones, I went through this long, arduous process to make a really cool-looking box that took a long time to put together and everything, and then I found a way to do a cool-looking box that I can do in 5 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh, I'm going to go back and fix all those earlier ones before we do this in print, because it'll just look better.
Right.
You know, stuff like that, and you know, It's like the old saying goes, somebody said it first, I heard it first out of George Lucas's mouth, but I know he wasn't the first person to say it, but, you know, you don't finish any work of art, you abandon it.
Right.
And that's eventually what'll have to happen with Red Skirts, is Dave and I are just going to have to eventually, you know, stop and say, okay, this is episode one, shoot it to the printer.
Mm-hmm. You know,
whatever happens at this point happens, but you know, right up to that point, I'll probably still be looking at it going, oh, okay, what can we do better on this page? What can we fix on this page? And kind of like the Star Trek redos, where they had better technology than when they did the ones in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know, So will we be seeing, you know, Red Skirts, the special editions later on?
we already did the special edition. We did a print version of the first part of the story. It's a limited, I think we did 25 issues or 50?
50.
We did 50, yeah, and if you're lucky enough to have one, hold on to it, because who knows. But, yeah, we did 50 of them. I think we sold them out in a convention.
Yeah, they went fast. That's kind of the cool thing about this project, too, is that people really really respond to it, and they're really enjoying it. This was just something that Al and I were kind of doing for fun that we thought would be enjoyable, you know. And I want to mention this too, just here real quick. I want to give a shout out to you, Al, and also to Lynn, because I've been very fortunate in that with Bushytails and Red Skirts, which are easily my two favorite things I've ever done, I've been very fortunate to have collaborative partners who are as vested in the project as I am. And they're doing more than probably they should. But at the same point, they're contributing so much that it makes the product and the story and the characters and everything so much more enriching and enjoyable for the readers, as well as for me as someone who's working on the project. And I want to thank both of you for just really, in all honesty, just being as vested as I am in it and really helping to craft and create something that, in my mind anyway, is special. So thank you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yes. You know, it's to me, the whole thing is an educational process that'll probably stop when I die. You know, and that should be comics. I mean, there are some comic artists out there who probably there isn't much else you're going to teach them. But I think by and large, if you talk to even someone working for Marvel or DC or what have you, they still find new things.
Right. If you stop learning, you stop growing.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, without this, I wouldn't have figured out. God, lettering is fun. It's like solving a puzzle. It's weirdly relaxing, and you know, I don't know that everybody can say that. I'm sure for some people, it's like lettering the comic is the absolute worst part of the process for them. But I don't know. For some reason, for me, it's like, ooh, now we can adjust the kerning here and make this look better. And you know, I still look at them and go, it still looks horrible. So.
Yeah. Yeah, let's move this pointer so they're not literally talking out of their butt.
Yeah.
that's my big pet peeve, man. When I see a professional comic with people talking out of their butts, I just cringe. I'm like, oh.
I learned, always have the pointer in some way pointing at their head, you know, unless you can't. Don't cross the streams.
Right.
You know, if two people are talking, you don't do that. Don't use perfectly oval balloons, which... That doesn't bug me as much. I see you do that one all the time. And I think another person is like, don't use pointed... what did you call it? The spike that...
The pointer thing?
Pointer, yeah. Don't use actual straight line pointers. Make sure there's some curve to it, which I like to do in mine. I like to put some curve to it.
Mm-hmm.
That one doesn't bug me as much either. And that's the thing with lettering. I say get the Starkings book, but there are like three other books you can get that'll teach you different rules that you must abide by, you know.
Mm-hmm. And learn and know when you can, you know, bend or break those rules, you know, before you actually go and break them. Know what the rules are first.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And there's like a reason why you're doing it, yeah.
Like, you know, don't use pointed streamers. Well, if the person's screaming something, yeah, I use a pointed, or a pointed pointer, I should say. Yeah. You know, because that just adds more drama to, okay, they're screaming this, they're making a point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you don't want it and give it that grace. You know, you want them to be forceful with it. So there's, yeah, like you say, learn the rules, break them, and find ones that make them your own. You know, some of the best books come from people who have made their own style of lettering, like Sunstone by, I am not going to say this guy's name right. It's Stepan Savagic. I'm going to say it wrong. It's from Image, Sunstone, and how do I pitch? It's about a couple that has a bondage relationship, and yet it is not really pornographic in nature. It's an actual honest look at that lifestyle. Very well done, amazing artwork. But he has his own style of doing the word balloons,
right?
And it's unique. It's his. You know, if another person were to try and ape it immediately, I think people who are familiar with Sunstone would be like, no, that he's copying that guy's style. So if you're fortunate enough to be able to come up with something like that, that's cool too.
I'd like to thank Al for being on our show. Always great to talk to you, Al. Can't wait to see you again. So
thank you.
Please tell the listeners where they can follow you online.
Yeah, definitely. The main place to catch me online outside of social media is at studiofugazi.com, and that's StudioFugazi. Just one word, studiofugazi.com. For those of you who don't know, Fugazi is an old GI term for fouled up, gone awry, zipped in, which kind of describes the type of graphic design work that I called in all the time to fix for people. They would go with a cheaper designer, and so I would call in to fix that mess. And so that's kind of where I just came up with the idea. I always like the term. And the band is cool, too, of course. But StudioFugazi.com. Also on Instagram, which is a great way to really get in touch with me, I try and do a daily sketch over lunch and put it out. So if you want to see some just oddball, wacky, weird stuff, I try and make them funny when I can. Go to Instagram and look for Studio. I think it's Studio_Fugazi. I think you have to put the underscore. But look for that. You'll find me. If you just see a bunch of weird drawings, that'll be me. Same thing on Facebook. There is a Studio Fugazi page on Facebook, and you can definitely follow me there if you're more interested in the art side of things. You know, generally, my personal Facebook page is Al Sparrow, but I won't follow you if I really don't know you. Don't take it personally.
It's just good thinking.
Yeah, you know, Facebook is what it is. I'm sure you're all very nice and lovely people, but, you know, if I don't know you, I tend to just break people. Go to the art page, because that's where the good stuff is, really, to be honest. You can also go to StudioFugazi.com, like I said, and that's where all the insanity is.
Well, fantastic. And any shows coming up?
Not really. I'm thinking of doing one in November up in Vegas. There's one that might be going up with my buddy Jan-Mark Quisenbing. And the last time that I did a show with him, we ended up buying luchador masks at 11 o'clock at night. So that's all good time.
And bail money was required. And
I'm scared to think what could happen if we ended up in Vegas together. But I'm kind of interested to find out. Okay. If not that, there will be other shows next year throughout the year.
Fantastic.
Yeah, there's nothing that puts fear in a waiter more than when you look at him and say, where can we get a luchador mask at this time of night?
God bless that waiter. He had an answer, though. That was the scary part.
All right, Dave, you want to tell folks where they can find you?
Oh, yes. So I thank you for listening to this episode. And Al, I want to thank you for being on the show.
Problem.
And it was really great to have you here. Good discussion, interesting points. If people are paying attention, I think there's a lot to learn. So you can learn more about me and my work at davebeatty.com. That's DaveBeatty.com. And all the social media links and all that nonsense you can find right there.
And all right. Yep, I am at linworkman.com, linworkman.com. And geekwilltravel.com, which is my geek travel blog. And you can also just follow me on Instagram and Twitter. And I do have an art page on my Facebook. So just look for Lynn Workman Art. And again, thanks to Al. Thanks for everybody for listening. And apparently we do have more listeners than just me listening at work. I found out. Dave sent me some stats, so that's great to know. And again, Dave, where can they find us online again? Because I know we're on... the Radio Rogues is on the Instagram and Twitter, but which other? No, we're on Libsyn, and now what else?
Well, we're on Libsyn, but you can also find us on Stitcher, and you're going to have to search for basically on all these platforms. You're going to have to search for basically the Rogues Radio podcast. But we're on Stitcher, we're on Spotify. I think actually we're on Google Play, even though I haven't been able to confirm that, but the stream is going to Google Play as well. And then, like I said, I submitted us to TuneIn, so if they accept the application, that'll be great. So maybe eventually you'll be able to say, Alexa, play the Rogues Radio podcast, and you'll be able to hear us talking and about comics and the craft of creating and all that kind of fun stuff.
Yeah. So please comment if you have any comments. And you know, again, share it if you can. Let your friends know that you're listening. And if there's anything you would like for us to discuss, you know, please get in touch with us. I'd also like to mention before we close here that we've recently lost three comic creators. We've lost Russ Heath, Gary Friedrich, and Marie Severin. The only one I ever met was Gary Friedrich. But I would like to, you know, say we're going to miss them. I did like all of their work. And again, comics has lost some more this year. But again, thanks again for listening. And we'll See you all next week.